Disc 7.
"Shout louder, you bastards!" Sir John called, and the attackers gave a ragged cry of St. George. "Louder!" A gun punched rancid smoke from the town's walls, and its stone slashed diagonally across the rough ground where the attackers advanced. A man-at-arms was struck on the thigh, and he spun around, blood splashing high on his jupon. And the gunstone kept going, disemboweling a page, and still it flew, blood drops trailing, to vanish somewhere over the marshes. An archer's bow snapped at the full draw, and he cursed.
"Don't give the bastards time, kill them!"
Sir John Cornwall bellowed as he jumped down onto the faggots that filled the ditch. And now the shouting was constant, as the first attackers staggered on the uneven faggots that did not entirely fill the moat. Crossbow bolts hissed down, and the defenders added stones and lengths of timber that they hurled from the barbican's high rampart. Two more guns fired from the town walls, belching smoke, their stones slashing harmlessly behind the attackers. Trumpets were calling in Harfleur, and the crossbows were shooting from the walls. So long as the attackers were close to the barbican, they were safe from the missiles loosed from the town, but some men were trying to clamber up the bastion's eroded flanks, and there they were in full sight of Harfleur's defenders. Hook emptied his arrow bag at the men on the barbican summit, then looked around for a page with more arrows, but could see none. "Horrocks," he shouted at his youngest archer, "go and find arrows." He saw a wounded archer, not one of his men, sitting a few paces away, and he took a handful of arrows from the man's bag and trapped one between his thumb and the bow stave. The English banners were at the foot of the barbican, and most of the men-at-arms were on its lower slopes, trying to climb between the flames that burned fiercely to blind the defenders with smoke. It was like trying to scramble up the face of a crumbling bluff, but a bluff in which fires burned and smoke writhed. The French were bellowing defiance. Their best weapons now were the stones they hurled down the face, and Hook saw a man-at-arms tumble back, his helmet half crushed by a boulder. The king was there, or at least his standard was bright against the smoke, and Hook wondered if the king had been the man he saw falling with a crushed helmet. What would happen if the king died? But at least he was there, in the fight. And Hook felt a surge of pride that England had a fighting king, and not some half-mad monarch who circled his body with straps because he believed he was made of glass. Sir John's banner was on the right now, joined there by the three bells on Sir William Porter's flag. Hook shouted at his men to follow as he ran to the ditch's edge. He jumped in, landing on the corpse of a man in plate armour. A crossbow bolt had pierced the man's aventail, spreading blood from his ravaged throat. Someone had already stripped the body of sword and helmet. Hook negotiated the uncertain faggots and hauled himself up the far side where the smoke was thick. He loosed three arrows, then put his last one across the bow stave. The flames were growing stronger as they fed on the barbican's broken timbers, and those fires, designed to blind the defenders, were now a barrier to the attackers. Arrows hissed overhead, evidence that the pages had found more and brought them to the archers, but Hook was too committed to the attack now to go back and replenish his arrow bag. He ran to his right, dodging bodies, unaware of the crossbow bolts that struck around him. He saw Sir John precariously perched on top of some iron-bound timbers from where he stared upwards at the men who taunted the attackers. One of those defenders appeared briefly and hoisted a boulder over his head, ready to hurl it down at Sir John, and Hook paused, drew, released, and his arrow caught the man in his armpit so that he turned slowly and fell back out of sight. A gust of the east wind swirled the smoke away from the barbican's right-hand flank, and Hook saw an opening there. A cave in the half-collapsed tower that had defended the seaward side. He slung the bow and took the poleaxe off his shoulder. He shouted incoherently as he ran, then as he jumped up the barbican's face and scrabbled for a foothold in the steep rubble slope. He was at the right-hand edge of the broken fort, and he could see down the southern face of Harfleur where the harbour lay. Defenders on the walls could also see him, and their crossbow bolts thumped into the barbican, but Hook had rolled into the cave that was a ledge of rubble sheltered by collapsed timbers. There was scarce room to move in the space that was little more than a wild dog's den. Now what? Hook wondered. The crossbow bolts were hissing just beyond his shallow refuge. He could hear men shouting, and it seemed to Hook that the French shouted louder, evidence they believed they were winning. He leaned slightly outwards, trying to get a glimpse of Sir John, but just then an eddy of wind blew a great gout of smoke to shroud Hook's eyrie. Yet just to his right, towards the face of the barbican, He saw the metal hoops that strapped three great tree trunks together, and the hoops, he thought, made a ladder upwards. And the smoke was hiding him, and so he leaped across and clung to the timbers with his left hand while his boots found a small foothold on another of the iron rings. He reached up with the poleaxe and hooked it over the top ring and hauled himself up, up, and he was nearly at the top, and the French had not seen him because of the smoke and because they were watching the howling mass of Englishmen who were trying to clamber up the Barbican centre, where the slope was the least precipitous. Bolts, stones and broken timbers rained down on them, while the English arrows flitted through the smoke in answer.
"Hook!" a voice roared beneath him. "Hook, you bastard, pull me up!"
It was Sir John Cornwell. Hook lowered the poleaxe, let Sir John grip the hammerhead, and then hauled him across to the timbers.
"You don't get ahead of me, Hook," Sir John growled. "And what in Christ's name are you doing here? You're meant to be shooting arrows."
"I wanted to see what was on the other side of this ruin," Hook said. Flames crept up the timbers, getting closer to Sir John's feet.
"You wanted to see..."
Sir John began, then gave a bark of laughter.
"I'm getting goddamn roasted. Pull me up more."
Hook again used the poleaxe to lift Sir John, this time to the top of the timbers. The two of them were like flies on a broken burning pillar, perched just below the makeshift parapet, but still unseen by the defenders.
"Sweet Jesus Christ and all his piss-drinking saints, but this seems a good enough place to die,"
Sir John said, and slipped the sling of his battle-axe off his shoulder.
"Are you going to die with me, Hook? Good man. Push me up first, then join me. And let's die well, Hook, let's die very well."
Hook took hold of the back of Sir John's sword-belt, and when he got the nod, heaved. Sir John vanished upwards, tumbled over the wall and gave his war shout.
"Harry and St. George!"
And for Harry, St. George and St. Crispinian, Hook followed and screamed.
"You won't die here," St. Crispinian said.
Hook hardly heard the voice because he was screaming a battle cry that was part terror and part exhilaration. Hook and Sir John had reached the top of the Barbican, where the remnants of the fighting platform lay. The English bombardment had shattered the Barbican's face so that the earth and rubble filling had spilled out, and what had once been the fighting platform was now a crude, lumpy space. The rearward wall, looking towards the city's Lure Gate, was much less damaged and served as a screen to hide what happened on the broken, rough summit from the defenders of Harfleur's walls. That summit was now a treacherous heap of earth, stones and burning timbers, which was crammed with crossbowmen and men-at-arms. Hook and Sir John had come from their left flank, and now Sir John attacked the enemy like the avenging angel. He was fast. That was why he was the most feared tournament fighter in Christendom. In the time it took a man to strike a blow, Sir John gave two. Hook saw it because once again it seemed to him that time itself had slowed. He was moving to Sir John's right, aware suddenly that St. Crispinian had broken his silence, and feeling a great surge of relief that the saint was still his patron. Hook lunged with his poleaxe as Sir John used his double-bladed battle-axe in short, brutal strokes. The first smashed the roundel protecting a man-at-arm's knee. The second, a rising slash, gutted a crossbowman, and the third felled the man-at-arms whose knee had been broken. Another man-at-arms turned to drive a sword at Sir John, but Hook's poleaxe sliced into his side, piercing the edge of his breastplate and throwing him back on the men behind. Hook just kept ramming, driving the man back, crushing him into his comrades, and Sir John was making a whooping noise, a sound of pure joy. Hook was screaming, though he was not aware of it, and using his huge archer's strength to push the enemy back while Sir John was taking advantage of their confusion to chop, wound and kill. Hook wrenched the poleaxe back, but the spear point was trapped in the man's armour.
"Take this!" Sir John said sharply, thrusting the axe at Hook,
and later, much later when the fight was over, Hook marvelled at Sir John's utter calm in the middle of a fight. Sir John had seen Hook's predicament and solved it, even though he was under attack himself. He gave Hook the axe, and in the time it took Hook to take it, Sir John drew his sword. It was Sir John's favourite sword, the one he called Darling, and it was a heavier blade than most, strong enough to survive hard lunges into steel plate. Sir John used it to keep the enemy off balance, letting Hook do the killing now. Hook's first blow drove the axe into a helmet, wrenching the whole visor loose so it hung askew.
"Cheap steel," Sir John said.
and his sword flickered at the men's faces, making them retreat, and Hook drove the blade into an armoured belly and saw the blood well out bright and fast.
"Flag!" Sir John bellowed. "Bring me my goddamn flag!"
Hook was standing with his feet apart, driving the axe at men who were hardly fighting back. They were hampered by the bodies at their feet and cowed by Sir John's sheer skill and ferocity. A determined man could have attacked into Sir John's sword and Hook's axe, but instead the defenders tried to back away from the blades while the Frenchman behind pushed them forward.
"Trois!"
Sir John was counting the men he had wounded or killed.
"Quatre! Come on, you goddamn bastards, I'm hungry!"
Hook's axe was the more dangerous weapon because of its power. The blade crumbled armour like parchment, or chopped into flesh like a slaughterman's cleaver, and Hook was grimacing as he swung, and the enemy thought he was smiling, and that smile was more frightening than the blade. The sheer press of Frenchmen made it impossible for their crossbowmen to take aim, while the surviving rear wall and the obscuring smoke hid the fight from the bowmen on the towers of the Lure Gate. Sir John was shouting, and Hook was keening a mad noise, and their blades were red. Hook was not trying to kill now. He was just thrusting the enemy back and putting men on the ground to make a barrier. A fallen man-at-arms made an upward cut with his sword, but Hook saw the lunge coming, took a half-step to one side, slammed the axe down hard onto the man's visor, heard the gurgling noise as the heavy blade crushed steel into flesh, swung the axe back to dent a man's breastplate, and then rammed the weapon forward to push a third man backwards.
"My flag!" Sir John shouted again. "I want these bastards to know who's killing them!"
His standard-bearer suddenly tumbled over the wall behind, and with him came more men-at-arms wearing Sir John's lion.
"Kill the bastards!" Sir John screamed,
but the bastards had taken enough. They were spilling through a gap in the rearward wall of the barbican and scrambling down a ladder or hurling themselves at a steep slope of spilt rubble before running through the smoke for the town's gate. The rising sun was lighting that smoke. Screaming Englishmen were killing the last defenders, who could not reach the gap in time. One man held out his glove in token of surrender, but an archer beat him down with a long-hafted hammer, and another skewered him with a poleaxe.
"Enough!" a voice shouted. "Enough! Enough! Hold your blows!" Sir John called. "Hold it, I said!" "God be thanked!"
the man who had first called to end the killing said. And Hook saw it was the king, who, sword in hand, suddenly knelt on the rubble and crossed himself. The king's surcoat, its bright badge crossed by St. George's red, was scorched. A springald bolt thumped into one of the timbers facing the town, making the wall quiver.
"Extinguish the flames!" the king called, getting to his feet.
He pulled off his helmet and its leather liner so that his thick cropped hair stuck up in small, sweat-dark clumps.
"And someone have pity on that man."
He gestured at the Frenchman who had tried to surrender, and who now writhed and moaned as blood soaked the folds just beneath his breastplate. The poleaxe was still embedded in his belly. A man at arms drew a knife, felt for the gap in the armour protecting the dying man's throat, and stabbed home once before working the blade around inside the gullet. The man convulsed, blood bubbled from the holes in his dented visor, then he gave a spasm and was still.
"God be thanked," the king said again.
An archer suddenly fell to his knees, and Hook thought the man was praying, but instead he vomited. Crossbow bolts were striking the barbican's rear wall, their strikes sounding like flails beating on a threshing floor. The king's banner was flying from the barbican now, and the heavy cloth twitched as the bolts ripped and tore at the weave.
"Sir John," the king said, "I must thank you." "For doing my duty, sire?" Sir John asked, going to one knee. "And this man helped," he added, gesturing at Hook.
Hook also dropped to one knee. The king gave him a glance, but showed no recognition.
"Many thanks to you all."
Water was poured on the flames, but the fire had penetrated deep into the barbican's shattered timbers, and they smouldered on, seeping a constant and choking smoke about the captured bastion. Its ragged summit was garrisoned by archers now, and that night they manhandled the messenger, one of the smaller cannon, up to its summit, and the gun splintered the timbers of the Lure Gate with its first shot. The heralds had ridden to that gate after the barbican's capture, and they had patiently explained that the English would now demolish the great gate and its towers, and that the fall of Harfleur was thus inevitable. and that the garrison should therefore do the sensible, even the honourable thing, and surrender before more men died. If they refused to surrender, the heralds declared, then the law of God decreed that every man, woman and child in Harfleur would be given to the pleasure of the English.
"Think of your pretty daughters," a herald called to the garrison's commanders, "and for their sake yield."
But the garrison would not surrender, and so the English dug new gun pits closer to the town, and they hammered the exposed Lure gate, demolishing the towers on either side and bringing down its stone arch. Yet still the defenders fought back. And the first chill wind of summer's end brought rain, and the sickness did not end, and Henry's army died in blood, vomit, and watery shit. And Harfleur remained French. It all had to be done again. Another assault, this time on the wreckage of the Lure gate, and to make sure the defenders could not concentrate their men on that western corner of the ramparts, the forces of the Duke of Clarence would assault the Montivilliers gate on the town's far side. This time Sir John said they were going into the town.
"The goddamn bastards won't surrender, so you know what you can do with the bastards. If it's got a prick, you kill it. If it's got tits, you hump it. Everything in that town is yours. Every coin, every ale pot, every woman, they're yours. Now go and get them."
And so the twin assaults streamed across the filled in ditches, and the arrows rained from the sky, and the trumpets blared a challenge to the uncaring sun, and the killing began again. And again it was Sir John Holland who led, which meant that Sir John Cornwall's men were in the front of the attack that swiftly captured the ruins of the Lure gate, and there abruptly was stopped. The gate had once led into a closely packed street of overhanging houses, but the garrison had pulled those buildings down to clear a killing space, behind which they had made a new barricade that had mostly been protected from the English gunstones by the remnants of the old wall and gate. The messenger, mounted on the barbican summit, had managed to shoot some stones at the fresh work, but it could only manage 3 shots a day, and the French repaired the damage between each shot. The new wall was built from masonry blocks, roof timbers and rubble-filled baskets, and behind it were crossbowmen. And as soon as the English men-at-arms appeared across the ruin of the Lure gate, the bolts began to fly. Archers shot back, but the French had been cunning. The new wall had been made with chinks and holes through which the crossbowmen could shoot, and which were small enough to defeat the aim of most arrows. Hook, crouching in the rubble of the old gate, reckoned that for every crossbowman shooting there were another 3 or 4 men spanning spare bows so that the bolts never stopped. Most crossbowmen were lucky to shoot 2 bolts a minute, but the bolts were coming from the loopholes far more frequently, and still more missiles spat from the high windows of the half-ruined houses behind the wall. This, Hook knew, was how Soissons should have been defended.
"We'll have to bring up a gun," Sir John snarled from another place in the ruined wall, but instead led a charge against the barricade, shouting at his archers to smother it in arrows.
They did, but the crossbow bolts kept coming, and even if the bolts failed to pierce armour, they threw a man back by sheer force, and when at last a half-dozen men managed to reach the wall and tried to pull down its timbers and stones, a cauldron was tipped over its coping, and a stream of boiling fish oil spilled down onto the attackers. They ran and limped back, some gasping from the pain of the scalding, and Sir John, his armour slick with the oil, came back with them and dropped into the gate's rubble and let loose a stream of impotent curses. The French were cheering. They waved taunting flags above their new low wall. A smoky haze shimmered behind the new rampart, promising that more heated oil would greet any new attack. The English catapults were trying to drop stones on the new wall, but most of the missiles flew long to crash down among the already shattered houses. The sun climbed. The late summer's heat had returned, and both attackers and defenders roasted in their armour. Boys brought water and ale. Men-at-arms, resting in the shelter of the Lure gate ruins, took off their helmets. Their hair was matted flat and their faces running with sweat. The archers crouched in the stones, sometimes shooting if a man showed himself, but for long periods neither side would loose an arrow or a bolt, but just wait for a target.
"Bastards," Sir John spat at the enemy.
Hook saw 2 defenders struggling to remove an earth-filled basket from a section of the new wall. He half stood and loosed an arrow, just as 12 other archers did the same. The 2 men fell back, each struck by arrows. But the basket fell with them, and Hook saw a cannon barrel squat and low, and he flattened himself in the gate's ruins just as the cannon fired. The air whistled and screamed. Stone chips were whipping in smoke, and a man gave a terrible long cry that turned to a whimper as the space in front of the wall was obscured by the thick smoke.
"Oh, my God," Will of the Dale said.
"You hurt, Will?"
"No, just tired of this place."
The French had loaded their cannon with a mass of small stones that had flayed the attackers. A man at arms was dead, a small hole punched clean through the top of his helmet. An archer staggered back towards the barbican, one hand clamped over an empty bloody eye socket.
"We're all gonna die here," Will said.
"No," Hook said fiercely, though he did not believe his protest. The gun smoke cleared slowly, and Hook saw that the earth-filled basket was back in its embrasure.
"Bastards," Sir John spat again.
"We're not giving up," the king was shouting. He wanted to assemble a mass of men-at-arms and attempt to overwhelm the wall with numbers, and his men were carrying orders to the Englishmen scattered in the old wall's ruins.
"Archers to the flanks!" a man shouted. "To the flanks!"
A French trumpeter began playing a short, sharp melody. It was three notes, rising and falling, repeated over and over. There was something taunting in the sound.
"Kill that bastard!" Sir John shouted,
but the bastard was hidden behind the wall.
"Move!" the king shouted.
Hook took a deep breath, then scrambled to his right. No crossbow bolt spat from the defences. The garrison was waiting, he thought. Perhaps they were running short of bolts, and so they were keeping what they had to greet the next assault. He sheltered by a stub of broken wall, and just then the French trumpeter stood on the new rampart and raised his instrument to his lips, and Hook stood too, and the cord came back to his right ear. He loosed, and the string whipped his bracer, and the goose-fledged arrow flew true, and the bodkin point took the trumpeter in the throat and drove clean through his neck, so that it stood proud at his nape. The braying trumpet screeched horribly and then ended abruptly as the man fell backwards. More English arrows flitted above him as he disappeared behind the wall, leaving a fading spray of misted blood and the dying echo of the trumpet's truncated call.
"Well done, that archer," Sir John shouted.
Hook waited. The day became still hotter, under a sun that was a great furnace in a sky clouded only by the shreds of the smoke from the beleaguered city. The French had stopped shooting altogether, which only convinced Hook that they were saving their missiles for the assault they knew was coming. Priests picked their way among the ruins of the old wall, shriving the dead and the dying, while behind the wall, in the space between the ruined Lure Gate and the shattered barbican, the men-at-arms assembled under their lord's banners. That force, at least 400 strong, was easily visible to the defenders, but still they did not shoot. One of Sir John's pages, a boy of 10 or 11 with a shock of bright blonde hair and wide blue eyes, brought two skins of water to the archers.
"We need arrows, boy," Hook told him.
"I'll bring some," the boy said.
Hook tipped the skin to his mouth.
"Why aren't the men-at-arms moving?" he asked no one in particular.
The king had assembled his assault force, and the archers were in place, but a curious lassitude had settled over the attackers.
"A messenger came,"
the page said nervously. He was a high-born lad, sent to Sir John's household to learn a warrior's ways, and in time he would doubtless be a great lord in shining armour mounted on a caparisoned horse, but for now he was nervous of the hard-faced archers who would one day be under his command.
"A messenger?"
"From the Duke of Clarence," the page said, taking back the water-skin.
The Duke, camped on the far side of Harfleur, was also attacking the city, though no sounds betrayed any fighting from that far-off gate.
"So what did the messenger tell us?" Hook asked the page.
"That the attack failed," the boy said.
"Sweet Jesus," Hook said in disgust.
So now he reckoned the king was waiting until his brother could mount another assault, and then the English would make one last effort from both east and west to overwhelm the stubborn defenders. And so Hook and his archers waited. If the king had sent new orders to his brother, then they would take at least 2 hours to reach him, for the messenger had to ride far around the city's north side and cross the flooded river by boat.
"What's happening?"
Sclate, the low-witted labourer with a giant strength, asked.
"I don't know," Hook confessed.
Sweat trickled down his face and stung his eyes. The air seemed to be filled with dust that coated his throat and made him thirsty again. The light reflecting from the shattered chalk of the broken walls was dazzling. He was tired. He unstrung the bow to take the tension from the stave.
"Are we attacking again?" Sclate asked.
I reckon we attack when the Duke assaults the far side, Hook suggested. Be a couple of hours yet.
They'll be ready for us, Sklait said gloomily.
The garrison would be ready, ready with cannons and crossbows and springalts and boiling oil. That was what waited for the men wearing the Red Cross. The men-at-arms were sitting now, resting before they were ordered into the killing ground.
When we attack, Sir John's voice broke the silence.
He was striding along the front of the sheltering archers, careless that he was fully exposed to the enemy, but the French crossbowmen, doubtless under orders to conserve their bolts, ignored him.
When we attack, he called again, you advance. You keep shooting, but you keep going forward. When we go over the wall, I want archers with us. We're going to have to hunt these bastards through their goddamn streets. I want you all there, and good hunting. This is a day to kill our king's enemies, so kill them.
And when the killing was done, Hook wondered how many English would be left. The army that had sailed from Southampton Water had been small enough, but now he reckoned there would just be half an army, many of them sick men, crammed into the ruins of Harfleur as the French army at last stirred itself to fight. Rumours said that enemy army was vast, a horde of men eager to wipe out the impudent English invaders, though God seemed to be doing that already by sickness.
Let's get it over with, Will o' the Dale grumbled.
Or let them keep the goddamn town, Tom Scarlett suggested. It's a shit heap now.
And what if the assault failed, Hook wondered. What if Harfleur did not fall? Then the remnants of Henry's army would sail back to England defeated. The campaign had begun so well, with all the panoply of banners and hope, and now it was blood and feces and despair. Another trumpeter began playing the same mocking notes from the city. Sir John, stalking back past his archers, turned and snarled towards the defenders.
I want that prick-sucking bastard killed! I want him killed!
The last four words were screamed at the wall, loud enough for any Frenchman to hear. Then, unexpectedly, a man clambered onto the wall's top. He was not the trumpeter who still blew from his place behind the wall. The man on the wall was unarmed, and he stood and waved both hands at the English. Archers stood, began to draw.
No, Sir John bellowed. No, 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 bows down, bows down, bows down.
The trumpet note wavered, faded and stopped. The man on the wall held his empty hands high above his head, and miraculously, suddenly, astonishingly, it was all over. The soldiers of Harfleur's garrison did not want to surrender, but the townspeople had suffered enough. They were hungry. Their houses had been crushed and burned by English missiles. Disease was spreading. They saw an inevitable defeat and knew that vengeful enemies would rape their daughters. The town council insisted that the city yield, and without the support of the men of Harfleur who shot crossbows from the walls, and without the food prepared by the women, the garrison could not prolong the fight. The Sieur de Gaucourt, who had led the defence, asked for a three-day truce in which he could send a messenger to the French king to discover whether or not a relief force was coming to the city's help. If not, then he would surrender on condition that the English army did not sack and rape the town. Henry agreed, and so priests and nobles gathered at the breach by the Lure Gate, and the leading men came from the town, and they all swore solemn oaths to abide by the terms of the truce. Afterwards, and after Henry had taken hostages to ensure that the garrison kept its word, a herald rode close under the walls and shouted up at the townsfolk who'd watched the ceremony. He called in French.
You have nothing to fear. The King of England has not come to destroy you. We are good Christians, and our Harfleur is not Soissons. You have nothing to fear.
Smoke drifted from the city to haze the late summer sky. It seemed strange that no guns fired and no trebuchets thumped as they launched their missiles, that the fighting had stopped. The dying did not stop. The corpses were still carried to the creeks and thrown to the gulls, and it seemed there would be no end to the sickness. And there was no French relief force. The French army was gathering to the east, but the message came back that it would not march to relieve Harfleur. And so, on the next Sunday, the feast day of St. Vincent, the city surrendered. A pavilion was erected on the hillside behind the English encampment, and a throne was placed under the canopy and draped with cloth of gold.
English banners flanked the pavilion, which was filled with the high nobility in their finest clothes. A man held aloft the king's great helm, which was ringed with a golden crown, while archers lined a long path that led across the rubble of the siege works to the ruined gate that had resisted so many attacks. Behind the archers were the rest of Henry's army, spectators to the day's drama. The King of England, crowned with a simple circlet of gold and wearing a surcoat blazoned with the French royal coat of arms, sat enthroned in silence. He was watching and waiting, and perhaps wondering what he must do next. He had come to Normandy and won the surrender, but that victory had cost him half his army. Hook was at the Lure Gate, where Sir John commanded a force of 10 men-at-arms and 40 archers. Sir John, clad in plate armour that had been scoured to a shine, was mounted on his great destrier, Lucifer, who had been draped in a dazzling linen trapper resplendent with Sir John's crest, and the same lion was modelled in painted wood to rear savagely from the crest of Sir John's helmet. The men-at-arms were also in armour, but the archers were in leather jerkins and stained breeches. All the bowmen carried halters of rough rope, the kind that the peasant might use to lead a cow to market.
"Treat them courteously," Sir John told his bowmen. "They fought well. They're men."
"I thought they were all scum-sucking cabbage shitters," Will o' the Dale said quietly, but not quietly enough.
Sir John turned Lucifer.
"They are that," he said. "But they fought like Englishmen, so treat them like Englishmen."
A section of the new wall had been demolished, and just after Sir John spoke, some 3 dozen men emerged from the gap. They had been ordered to approach the King of England barefoot and in plain linen shirts and hose. Now nervous and apprehensive, they walked slowly and cautiously towards the waiting archers.
"Nooses," Sir John ordered.
Hook and the other archers tied nooses in the ropes. Sir John beckoned a squire and handed his reins to the man, then slid out of his tall saddle. He patted Lucifer on the nose, then walked towards the approaching Frenchman. He singled out one man, a tall man with a hooked nose and a short black beard. The man was pale, and Hook guessed he was sick, but he was forcing himself to lead the Frenchman out of the town and to keep what small dignity he had left. The bearded man beckoned to his companions to pause while he approached Sir John alone. The 2 men stopped, a pace apart, the Englishman glorious in armour and heraldry, his sword hilt polished, his armour gleaming, while the Frenchman was in the common, ill-fitting clothes decreed by King Henry. Sir John, his visor raised, said something that Hook did not catch, then the 2 men embraced. Sir John left his right arm about the Frenchman's shoulders as he led him towards the archers.
"This is the Sieur de Gaucourt," he announced. "The leader of our enemies these 5 last weeks, and he has fought bravely. He deserves better than this, but our king commands and we must obey. Hook, give me the noose."
Hook held out the halter. The Frenchman gave him an appraising look, and Hook felt compelled to nod his head in respectful acknowledgement.
"I am sorry," Sir John said in French. "It is necessary," Raoul de Gaucourt said harshly.
"Is it?" Sir John asked.
"We must be humiliated so that the rest of France knows what fate waits for them if they resist your king," de Gaucourt said.
He gave a wan smile, then cast an appraising eye over the English army that waited to watch his humiliating walk to the king's throne.
"Though I doubt your king has the power to frighten France any more," he went on. "You call this a victory, Sir John?" he asked, beckoning at the battered walls he had defended so bravely.
Sir John did not answer. Instead, he lifted the noose to place it about de Gaucourt's head, but the Frenchman took it from him.
"Allow me," he said, and put the rope about his own neck.
The other Frenchmen had ropes placed about their necks, and then Sir John, satisfied, pulled himself back into Lucifer's saddle. He nodded to de Gaucourt, then spurred his horse along the path made between the watching English soldiers. The Frenchmen walked the path in silence. Some, the merchants, were old men, while others, mostly soldiers, were young and strong. They were the knights and burgesses, the men who had defied the King of England, and the nooses about their necks proclaimed that their lives were now at Henry's mercy. They climbed the hillside, then knelt humbly before the throne canopied in cloth of gold. Henry gazed at them a long time. The wind lifted the silk banners and drifted smoke from the city's ruins. The assembled English nobles waited, expecting the king to announce the death sentence on the kneeling men.
I am the rightful king of this realm, Henry said, and your resistance was treason. A look of pain showed briefly on the Gokor's face. He ignored the accusation of treason and instead held out a thick bunch of heavy keys.
The keys of Afleur, sire, he said, which are yours.
The king did not take the offered keys.
Your defiance, he said sternly, was contrary to man's law and to God's law.
Some of the older merchants were shaking in fear, and one had tears running down his face.
But God, Henry went on loftily, is merciful.
He lifted the keys at last.
And we shall be merciful. Your lives are not forfeit.
A cheer sounded from the English army when the cross of St. George was hoisted over the town. Next day, Henry of England walked barefoot to the church of St. Martin to give thanks to God for a victory, yet many who watched his humble pilgrimage reckoned that his triumph was a virtual defeat. He had wasted so much time before Harfleur's walls, and the sickness had torn his army apart, and the campaign season was almost over. The English army moved inside the walls. They burned their encampment and dragged catapults and cannon through the ruined gate. Sir John's men quartered themselves in a row of houses, taverns and warehouses beside the wall-enclosed harbour, where Hook found space in the attic of a tavern called Le Péan.
Le Péan is a bird, Melisande had explained. With a big tail,
she had spread her arms wide.
No bird's got a tail that big, Hook said.
Le Péan does, she insisted.
Must be a French bird then, Hook said, not an English one.
Harfleur was now English. The cross of St. George flew from the ruined stump of St. Martin's Tower, and the people of the city who had suffered so much were now given more suffering. They were expelled. The city, the king declared, would be resettled by English people, just as Calais had been. And to make room for those new inhabitants, over 2,000 men, women and children were driven from the city. The sick were taken in carts, the rest walked, and 200 mounted Englishmen guarded the sad column's progress along the north bank of the Seine. The English soldiers were there to protect the refugees from their own countrymen, who would otherwise have robbed and raped. Men-at-arms led the procession and archers flanked it. Hook was one of the archers. He had been reunited with his black gelding Raker, who was fretful and needed constant curbing. Hook's surcoat was washed clean, though the red cross of St. George had faded to a dull pink. Beneath the surcoat he wore a coat of good mail that he had taken from a French corpse, and an aventail that Sir John had given him, and over the aventail's hood he now had a bassinet that was another gift from a corpse. The bassinet was a helmet with a wide-brimmed design to deflect a downwards blade. Though like other archers, Hook had hacked off the brim on the right side to make a space for his bow's cord when he drew it to the full. His sword hung at his side. His case bow was slung across his shoulder, while his arrow bag hung from the saddle's cantle. To his right, beyond the refugees, the narrowing river rippled sun-bright, while to the left were meadows stripped of livestock by English forage parties and, beyond those pastures, gentle wooded hills still heavy in their full summer leaf. Melisande had stayed in Harfleur, but Father Christopher had insisted on accompanying the refugees. He was mounted on Sir John's great destrier Lucifer. Sir John wanted the horse exercised, and Father Christopher was happy to oblige.
You shouldn't have come, Father, Hook told him.
You're a doctor of medicine now, Hook.
You're supposed to rest, Father.
There'll be rest enough in heaven, Father Christopher said happily.
He was still pale, but he was eating again. He was wearing a priest's robe, something he had done more frequently since his recovery.
I learned something during that illness, the priest said in apparent seriousness.
Aye, what was that?
In heaven, Hook, there will be no shitting.
Hook laughed.
But will there be women, Father?
In abundance, young Hook. But what if they're all good women?
You mean the bad ones will all be in the devil's cellar, Father?
That is a worry, Father Christopher said with a smile. But I trust God to make suitable arrangements.
He grinned, happy to be alive and riding under a September sun beside a hedge thick with blackberries. A corncrake's grating cry echoed from the hills. Just after dawn, when the protesting refugees had been forced out of Harfleur, a stag had appeared on the Rouen road, resplendent in his new antlers. Hook had taken it as a good omen, but Father Christopher, looking up at the dark branches of a dead elm tree, now found a gloomy one.
The swallows are gathering early,
he said.
A bad winter, then, Hook said.
It means summer's end, Hook, and with it go our hopes. Like those swallows, we will disappear.
Back to England.
And to disappointment, the priest said sadly. The king has debts to pay, and he can't pay them. If he had carried home a victory, then it wouldn't matter.
We won, father, Hook said. We captured our Fleur.
We used a pack of wolfhounds to kill a hare, Father Christopher said. And out there, he nodded eastwards, there's a much larger pack of hounds gathering.
Some of that larger pack appeared at midday. The front of the long column of refugees had stopped in some meadows beside the river, and now the tail of the column crowded in behind them. What had checked their progress was a band of enemy horsemen who had barred the road where it led through the gate of a walled town. The townsfolk watched from the walls. The enemy had a single banner, a great white flag on which a red and double-headed eagle spread its long talons. The French men-at-arms were dressed for battle, their polished armour gleaming beneath bright surcoats, but few wore helmets, and those who did had their visors raised, a clear sign that they expected no fighting. Hook guessed there were 100 enemy, and they were here under an arranged truce to receive the refugees, who were to be taken to Rouen in a fleet of barges that was moored on the river's northern bank.
Dear God,
Father Christopher said, staring at the eagle banner, which lifted and fell in the wind that drove ripples across the river.
That's the Marshal,
Father Christopher explained, making the sign of the cross.
The Marshal?
Jean Dumont, Lord of Boucicault, Marshal of France.
Father Christopher said the name and title slowly, his voice betraying admiration for the man who wore the badge of the double-headed eagle.
Never heard of him, Father, Hook said cheerfully.
France is ruled by a madman, the priest said. And the royal dukes are young and headstrong, but our enemies do have the Marshal, and the Marshal is a man to fear.
Sir William Porter, Sir John Cornwall's brother-in-arms, led the English contingent, and he now rode bareheaded to greet the Marshal, who in turn spurred his destrier towards Sir William. The Frenchman, who was a big man on a tall horse, towered over the Englishman as the two spoke, and Hook, watching from a distance, thought they laughed together. Then, invited by a gesture from the courtly Sir William, the Marshal of France kicked his horse towards the English troops. He ignored the French civilians and instead rode slowly down the ragged line of men-at-arms and archers. The Marshal wore no helmet. His hair was dark brown, cut bluntly short and greying at the temples, and it framed a face of such ferocity that Hook was taken aback. It was a square, blunt face, scarred and broken, beaten by battle and by life, but undefeated. A hard face, a man's face, a warrior's face, with keen dark eyes that searched men and horses for clues to their condition. His mouth was set in a grim line, but suddenly smiled when he saw Father Christopher, and in the smile Hook saw a man who might inspire other men to great loyalty and victory.
A priest on a destrier, the Marshal said amused. We mount our priests on knackered mares, not on war charges.
We English have so many destriers, sire, Father Christopher answered, that we can spare them for men of God.
The Marshal looked appraisingly at Lucifer.
A good horse, he said. Whose is it?
Sir John Cornwell's, the priest answered.
Ah, the Marshal was pleased. You will give the good Sir John my compliments. Tell him I am glad he has visited France and that I hope he will carry fond memories of it back to England. And that he will carry them very soon.
The Marshal smiled at Father Christopher, then looked at Hook with apparent interest, taking in the archer's weapons and armour before holding out a steel gauntleted hand.
Do me the honour, he said, and lend me your bow.
Father Christopher translated for Hook, who had understood anyway, but had not responded because he was not certain quite what he should do.
Let him have the bow, Hook, Father Christopher said, and string it first.
Hook uncased the great stave, placed its lower end in his left stirrup and looped the noose about the upper nock. He could feel the raw power in the tensed yew-stave. It sometimes seemed to him that the wood came alive when he strung the bow. It seemed to quiver in anticipation. The Marshal was still holding out his hand, and Hook stretched the bow towards him.
It is a large bow, Boucicault said in very careful English.
One of the largest I've seen, Father Christopher said, and it's carried by a very strong archer.
A dozen French men-at-arms had followed the marshal, and they watched from a few paces away as he held the stave in his left hand and tentatively pulled on the string with his right. His eyebrows lifted in surprise at the effort it took, and he gave Hook an appreciative glance. He looked back to the bow, hesitated, then raised it as though there were an imaginary arrow on the string. He took a breath, then pulled. English archers watched, half smiling, knowing that only a trained archer could pull such a bow to the full draw. The cord went back halfway and stopped. Then Boucicault hauled again, and the string kept going back, back until it had reached his mouth, and Hook could see the strain showing on the Frenchman's face. But Boucicault was not finished. He gave a small grimace, pulled again, and the cord went all the way to his right ear. And he held it there at the full draw and looked at Hook with a raised eyebrow. Hook could not help it. He laughed, and suddenly the English archers were cheering the French marshal, whose face showed pure delight as he slowly relaxed his grip and handed the bow back to Hook. Hook, grinning, took the stave and half bowed in his saddle.
Englishman, Boucicault called. Here.
He tossed Hook a coin and, still smiling delightedly, rode on down the line of applauding archers.
I told you, Father Christopher said, smiling. He's a man.
A generous man, Hook said, staring at the coin. It was gold, the size of a shilling, and he guessed it was worth a year's wages. He pushed the gold into his pouch, which held spare arrowheads and three spare cords.
A good and generous man, Father Christopher agreed, but not a man to be your enemy.
Nor am I, a voice intruded, and Hook twisted in his saddle to see that one of the men-at-arms who had followed the marshal was the Sieur de Lonferel, who now leaned on his saddle's pommel to stare at Hook. He looked down at Hook's missing finger, and a suggestion of a smile showed on his face.
Are you my son-in-law yet?
No, sire, Hook said, and named Lonferel to Father Christopher.
The Frenchman looked speculatively at the priest.
You've been ill, father.
I have, Father Christopher agreed.
Is this a judgment of God? Did he in his mercy strike your army as a punishment for your king's wickedness?
Wickedness? Father Christopher asked gently.
In coming to France, Lonferel said, then straightened in his saddle.
His hair was oiled so that it clung sleek, raven black and shining to his waist, which was encircled by a silver-plated sword belt. His face, so strikingly handsome, was even darker after a summer in the sun, making his eyes seem unnaturally bright.
Yet I hope you stay in France, father.
Is that an invitation?
It is, Lonferel smiled, showing very white teeth. How many men do you have now?
We are counted as the grains of sand on the seashore, the priest answered blithely. And are as numerous as the multitudinous stars of the firmament, and are as many as the biting fleas in a French whore's crotch.
And just about as dangerous, Lonferel said, unbidden by the priest's defiant words. You number what? Fewer than 10,000 now? And I hear your king is sending the sick men home.
He sends men home, Father Christopher said, because we have enough to do whatever must be done.
Hook wondered how Lonferel knew that the sick were being sent home, then supposed that French spies must be watching Harfleur from the surrounding hills, and would have seen the litters being carried out onto the English ships that could at last come right into the walled harbour.
And your king brings reinforcements, Lonferel said. But how many of his men must he leave in Harfleur to protect its broken walls?
1,000? He smiled again.
It is such a little army, father.
But at least it fights, Father Christopher said, whereas your army slumbers in Rouen.
But our army, Lonferel said, his voice suddenly harsh, truly does number as the fleas in a Parisian whore's crutch. He gathered his reins. I do hope you stay, father, and come to where the fleas can feed on English blood. He nodded to Hook. Give Milassin my compliments, and give her something else. He turned in his saddle. Jean, venez.
The same dull-faced squire who had gazed at Melisande in the woods above Harfleur, spurred to his master, and on Lonferel's orders, fumbled his jupon over his head. the Sieur de Lanferel took the gaudy garment with its bright sun and proud falcon and folded it into a square that he threw at Hook.
"If it comes to a battle," he said, "tell Melisande to wear that. It might be sufficient to protect her. I would regret her death. Good day to you both."
And with that he rode on after the marshal. Clouds gathered the next day, piling above the sea and slowly drifting to make a pall over Harfleur. The archers were busy making temporary repairs to the breached walls, building timber palisades that must serve as a defence until masons came from England to remake the ramparts properly. Men were still falling ill, and the battered street stank of sewage that oozed into the river Lazard that once again ran free through a stone channel bisecting the town, and thence into the tight harbour that smelt like a cesspit. The king sent a challenge to the Dauphin, offering to fight him face to face, and the winner would inherit the crown of France from the mad King Charles.
"He won't accept," Sir John Cornwell said.
Sir John had come to watch the archers pound stakes into the ground to support the new palisade.
"The Dauphin's a fat, lazy bastard, and our Henry is a warrior. It would be like a wolf fighting a piglet."
"And if the Dauphin doesn't agree to fight, Sir John?" Thomas Evelgold asked.
"We'll go home, I suppose," Sir John said unhappily.
That was the opinion throughout the army. The days were shortening and becoming colder, and soon the autumn rains would arrive, and that would mean the end of the campaign season. And even if Henry had wanted to continue the campaign, his army was too small and the French army was too big, and sensible men, experienced men, declared that only a fool would dare defy those odds.
"If we had another 6,000 or 7,000 men," Sir John said, "I dare say we could bloody their goddamn noses, but we won't. We'll leave a garrison to hold this shithole and the rest of us will sail home."
Reinforcements still arrived, but they were not many, not nearly enough to make up the numbers who had died or who were sick. But the boats brought them into the stinking harbour, and the uncertain newcomers came down the gangplanks to stare wide-eyed at the broken roofs and the shattered churches and the scorched rubble.
"Most of us will be going home soon," Sir John told his men,
"and the newcomers can defend Harfleur." He spoke sourly. The capture of Harfleur was not enough to compensate for the money spent and the lives lost. Sir John wanted more, as the rumour said the king did, but every other great lord, the royal dukes, the earls, the bishops, the captains, all advised the king to go home.
"There's no choice,"
Thomas Evelgold told Hook one evening. The great lords were at a council of war, meeting the king in an attempt to beat sense into his ambitious head, and the army waited on the council's decision. It was a beautiful evening, a sinking sun casting shadows long over the harbour. Hook and Evelgold were sitting at a table outside at Le Péon, drinking ale that had been brought from England because the breweries of Harfleur had all been destroyed.
"We have to go home," Evelgold said,
evidently thinking of the heated discussion that was doubtless being waged in the Guild Hall beside St. Martin's Church.
"Maybe we stay as part of the garrison," Hook suggested.
"Christ, no," Evelgold said harshly, then crossed himself. "That goddamn great army of the French, they'll take this town back with no trouble. They'll beat down our palisades in 3 days, then kill every man here."
Hook said nothing. He was watching the harbour's narrow entrance, where an arriving ship was being propelled by huge sweeps because the wind had fallen to a whisper. Gulls wheeled above the ship's single mast and over her high, richly gilded castles.
"The Holy Ghost," Evelgold said, nodding at the ship.
The Holy Ghost was a new ship, built with the king's money to support his invading army, but now she was chiefly employed in taking diseased men home to England. She crept closer and closer to the quay. Hook could see men on her deck, but they were not nearly as many as the ship had brought on her previous voyage, and he guessed these might be the last reinforcements to arrive.
1,500 ships board us here," Evelgold said, "but we won't need that many to take us home." He laughed bitterly. "What a waste of a goddamn summer."
The sun glinted reflections from the gilding on the Holy Ghost's two castles. The passengers on board stared at the shore.
"Welcome to Normandy," Evelgold said. "Will your woman go back to England?"
"She will."
"Thought you were getting married."
"I think we are."
"Do it in England, Hook."
"Why England?"
"Because it's God's country. Not like this goddamn place."
Sentinels and men-at-arms had come to the quay to discover if any of the newcomers belonged to their companies. Lord Slayton's sentinel, William Snowball, was one of them, and he greeted Hook civilly.
"I'm surprised to see you here, Master Snowball," Hook said.
"Why?"
"Who's stewarding while you're here?"
"John Willits. He can manage well enough without me, and his lordship wanted me to come."
"Because you've got experience," Elvigold put in.
"Aye, there's that," Snowball agreed. "And his lordship wanted me to keep an eye on..."
He hesitated.
"Well, you know."
"Sir Martin," Hook asked. "And why in God's name did he send him?"
"Why do you think?" Snowball answered harshly.
Hook mimed drawing a knife across his throat.
"Is that what he hopes?"
"He hopes Sir Martin will minister to our souls," Snowball said distantly, and then perhaps thinking he had betrayed too much, walked some distance down the wharf.
Hook watched the Holy Ghost creep closer.
"Are we expecting any new men?" he asked.
"None that I know of. Sir John hasn't said anything."
"He's not happy," Hook said.
"Because he's crazy, moon-touched, daft as a hare," Thomas Evergold brooded for a moment. "He wants to march into France. Man's daft. He wants us all dead. But it's all right for him, isn't it?"
"All right."
"He won't be killed, will he? What happens if we march into France to find a battle? The gentry don't get killed, Hook. They get taken prisoner. But no one will ransom you and me. We get slaughtered, Hook, while their lordships go off to some comfortable castle and get fed and given whores. Sir John don't care. He just wants a fight. But he knows he'll like as not live through a battle. He should give a thought to us."
Evergold drained his ale.
"Still, won't happen. We'll all be home by St. Martin's feast day."
"The king wants to march," Hook said.
"The king can count as well as you and me," Evergold said dismissively, "and he won't march."
Lines were hurled from the Holy Ghost to be caught by men ashore, and slowly, laboriously, the great ship was hauled into the quay. Gangplanks were lowered, and then the newcomers, looking unnaturally clean, were chivied ashore. There were around 60 archers, all carrying cased bows, arrow bags and bundles. The red crosses of St. George on their jupons looked very bright. A priest came down the nearer gangplank, fell to his knees on the wharf and made the sign of the cross. Behind him were four archers wearing the Slayton moon and stars, and one of them had springy gold hair sticking wildly from beneath his helmet's brim. For a heartbeat, Hook did not believe what he saw. Then he stood and shouted,
"Michael! Michael!"
It was his younger brother. Michael saw him and grinned.
"My brother!"
Hook explained to Evelgold, then strode to meet Michael. They embraced.
"My God, it is you," Hook said.
William Snowball called Michael's name, but Hook turned on the steward.
"He'll come when he's ready, Master Snowball. Where are you quartered?"
Snowball grudgingly told him, and Hook promised to bring his brother, then took Michael to the table and poured a pot of ale. Thomas Evergold left them alone.
"What in God's name are you doing here?" Hook demanded.
"Lord Slayton sent his last archers," Michael said, grinning. "He reckoned you all needed help. I didn't even know you were here."
Then there was a catching up of news. Hook said that Robert Peril had been killed in the siege, though he did not say how, and Michael told how their grandmother had died, a fact that did not trouble Hook in the least.
"She was a bitter old bitch," he said. "She looked after us, though," Michael said. "She looked after you, not me."
Then Melisande came from the tavern, and she was introduced, and Hook felt a sudden, wild and unfamiliar happiness. The two people he loved most were with him, and he had money in his pockets, and all seemed well with the world. The campaign in France might be over, and over before it had gained any great victory, but he was still happy.
"I'll ask Sir John if you can join us," he told Michael.
"I don't think Lord Slayton will allow that," Michael said.
"Aye, well, we can only ask."
"So what's going to happen here?"
Michael wanted to know.
"I reckon some poor bastards would be left here to defend this town," Hook said, "and the rest of us will go home."
"Go home?"
Michael frowned.
"But we just got here."
"That's what folk are saying. The lords are trying to make the decision now, but it's too late in the year to go marching inland, and besides, the French army's too big. We'll be going home."
"I hope not," Michael said. He grinned. "I didn't come this far to go home again. I want to fight."
"No, you don't," Hook said,
and surprised himself by saying it. Melisande was also surprised, looking at him curiously.
I don't.
It's blood, Hook said. And men crying for their mothers, and too much screaming and pain and bastards in metal trying to kill you. Michael was taken aback.
They say we just shoot arrows at them, he said falteringly.
Aye, you do, but in the end, brother, you have to get close, close enough to see their eyes, close enough to kill them.
And Nicholas is good at that,
Melisande said flatly. Not every man is, Hook said, suspecting that Michael, with his generous and trusting nature, lacked the ruthlessness to get close and commit slaughter.
Maybe just one battle, Michael said wistfully. Not a very big one.
Hook took Michael through the town at sundown. Lord Slayton's men had found houses close to the Montevilliers gate, and Hook led his brother there, and so into the yard of a merchant's house where the archers were quartered. His old companions went silent as the Hook brothers appeared. There was no sign of Sir Martin, but Tom Peril, dark and brooding, was sitting against a wall, and he stared expressionless at the two Hooks. William Snowball sensed trouble and stood up.
"Michael's joining you," Hook announced loudly. "And Sir John Cornwall wants you to know that my brother is under his protection."
Sir John had said no such thing, but none of Lord Slayton's men would know that. Tom Peril gave a mocking laugh, but said nothing. William Snowball confronted Hook.
"There be no trouble," he agreed. "There will indeed be no trouble."
A voice echoed the statement, and Hook turned to see Sir Edward Derwent, Lord Slayton's captain who had been captured in the mine, standing in the courtyard entrance. Sir Edward had been freed when the town surrendered, and Hook reckoned he must have been at the Council of War because he was dressed in his finest clothes. Sir Edward now strode to the courtyard centre.
"There will be no trouble," he said again. "None of you will fight each other because your job is to fight the French."
"I thought we were going home," Snowball said, puzzled.
"Well, you're not," Sir Edward said. "The king wants more, and what the king wants, he gets."
"We're staying here?" Hook asked, incredulous.
"In Harfleur?" "No, Hook," Sir Edward said. "We're marching."
He sounded grim, as though he disapproved of the decision. But Henry was king, and as Sir Edward had said, what the king wanted, the king got. And what Henry wanted was more war, and so the army would march into France.
Part 3. To the River of Swords.
There were to be no heavy wagons taken on the march. Instead, the baggage would be carried by men, pack horses and light carts.
"We have to travel fast," Sir John explained.
"It's pride," Father Christopher told Hook later. "Nothing but pride."
"Pride?"
"The king can't just crawl back to England with nothing but Harfleur to show for his money. He has to do more than merely kick the French dog. He feels a need to pull its tail as well."
The French dog did appear to be sleeping. Reports said the enemy army grew ever larger, but it showed no sign of stirring from around Rouen. And so the King of England had decided he would show Christendom that he could march from Harfleur to Calais with impunity.
"It isn't that far," Sir John told his men. "Maybe a week's march."
"And what do we gain from a week's march through France?" Hook asked Father Christopher.
"Nothing," the priest said bluntly.
"So why do it?"
"To show that we can, to show that the French are helpless."
"And we travel without the big wagons," Father Christopher grinned.
"We don't want the helpless French to catch us, do we? That would be a disaster, young Hook. So we can't take 200 heavy wains with us. That would slow us down far too much. So it will be horses, spurs, and the devil take the hindmost. This is important," Sir John had told his men.
He had stormed into the Peon's taproom and hammered one of the barrels with the hilt of his sword.
"Are you awake? Are you listening? You take food for 8 days, and all the arrows you can carry. You take weapons, armour, arrows and food, and nothing else. If I see any man carrying anything other than weapons, armour, arrows and food, I'll shove that useless baggage down his goddamn gullet and pull it out his goddamn arse. We have to travel fast."
"It all happened before," Father Christopher told Hook next morning.
"Before?"
"You don't know your history, Hook."
"I know my grandfather was murdered and my father too."
I do so love a happy family, the priest said. But think back to your great-grandfather's time when Edward was king, the third Edward. He was here in Normandy and decided to make a quick march to Calais, only he got trapped halfway and died. Oh, good God, no. He beat the French. You've surely heard of Crécy.
Oh, I've heard of Crécy, Hook said. Every archer knew of Crécy. The battle where the bowmen of England had cut down the nobility of France.
So you know it was a glorious battle, Hook, in which God favoured the English. But God's favour is a fickle thing.
Are you telling me he's not on our side?
I'm telling you that God is on the side of whoever wins, Hook.
Hook considered that for a moment. He was sharpening arrowheads, slithering the bodkins and broadheads against a stone. He thought of all the tales he had heard as a child when old men had spoken of the arrow storms of Crécy and Poitiers, then flourished a bodkin at Father Christopher.
If we meet the French, he said stoutly, we'll win. We'll punch these through their armour, Father.
I have a grievous suspicion that the king agrees with you, the priest said gently. He really does believe God is on his side, but his brother evidently does not.
Which brother? Hook asked. The Duke of Clarence and the Duke of Gloucester were both with the army.
Clarence, Father Christopher said. He's sailing home.
Hook frowned at that news. The Duke, according to some men, was an even better soldier than his older brother. Hook inspected a bodkin. Most of the long narrow head was dark with rust, but the point was now shining metal and wickedly sharp. He tested it by pricking the ball of his hand, then wet his fingers and smoothed out the fledgling.
Why's he going?
I suspect he disapproves of his brother's decision, Father Christopher said blandly. Officially, of course, the Duke is ill, but he looked remarkably well for an ailing man. And of course, if Henry is killed, God forbid, Clarence will become King Thomas.
Ah, Harry won't die, Hook said fiercely.
He very well might if the French catch us, the priest said tartly. But even our Henry has listened to advice. He was told to go home. He wanted to march to Paris, but he settled for Calais instead. And with God's help, Hook, we should reach Calais long before the French can reach us.
You make it sound as if we're running away.
Not quite, the priest said, but almost. Think of your lovely Melisande.
Hook frowned, puzzled.
Melisande?
The French are gathered at her belly button, Hook, and we are perched on her right nipple. What we plan to do is run to her left nipple and hope to God the French don't make it to her cleavage before us.
And if they do?
Then the cleavage will become the Valley of the Shadow of Death, Father Christopher said. So pray that we march fast and that the French go on sleeping.
You can't be fussy, Sir John had told his archers in the taproom. We can't pack arrows in barrels. We don't have the carts to carry barrels. And you can't use discs, so bundle them tight.
Bundled arrows suffered from crushed fledgings, and crushed fledgings made arrows inaccurate. But there was no choice but to bind the arrows in tight sheaves that could be hung from a saddle or across a pack horse's back. It took 2 days to tie the sheaves, for the king was demanding that every available arrow be carried on the journey, and that meant carrying hundreds of thousands of arrows. As many as possible were heaped on the light farm carts that would accompany the army, but there were not enough such vehicles, so even men-at-arms were ordered to tie the bundles behind their saddles. There were just 5,000 archers marching to Calais, and in 1 minute those men were capable of shooting 60,000 or 70,000 arrows, and no battle was ever won in a minute.
If we take every arrow we've got, there still won't be enough, Thomas Evelgold grumbled. And then we'll be throwing rocks at the bastards.
A garrison was left at Harfleur. It was a strong force of over 300 men-at-arms and almost 1,000 archers, though it was short of horses because the king demanded that the garrison give up every beast except the knights, war-trained destriers. The horses were needed to carry arrows. The new defenders of Harfleur were left perilously short of arrows themselves, but new ones were expected to arrive any day from England, where foresters cut ash shafts, blacksmiths forged bodkins and broadheads, and fledgers bound on the goose feathers.
"We will march swiftly," a priest with a booming voice shouted.
It was the day before the army marched, and the priest was visiting every street in Harfleur with a parchment on which the king's orders had been written. The priest's job was to make certain every man understood the king's commands.
"There will be no straggling. Above all, the property of the church is sacred. Any man who plunders church property will be hanged. God is with us, and we march to show that by his grace we are the masters of France."
"You heard him," Sir John shouted as the priest walked on. "Keep your thieving hands off church property. Don't rape nuns. God doesn't like it, and nor do I."
That night in the church of St. Martin, Father Christopher made Hook and Melisande man and wife. Melisande cried, and Hook, as he knelt and gazed at the candles guttering on the altar, wished St. Crispinian would speak to him, but the saint said nothing. He wished he had thought to summon his brother to the church, but there had been no opportunity. Father Christopher had simply insisted that it was time Hook made Melisande his wife, and so had taken them to the broken-spired church.
"God be with you," the priest said when the brief ceremony was done.
"He has been," Melisande said.
"Then pray that he stays with you, because we need God's help now."
The priest turned and bowed to the altar.
"By God, we need it," he added ominously. "The Burgundians have marched."
"To help us?" Hook asked.
It seemed so long ago that he had worn the ragged red cross of Burgundy and watched as the troops of France had massacred a city.
"No," Father Christopher said. "To help France."
"But," Hook began, then his voice trailed away.
"They have made up their family quarrel," Father Christopher said, "and so turned against us."
"And we're still gonna march?" Hook asked.
"The king insists," Father Christopher said bleakly. "We are a small army at the edge of a great land," he went on. "But at least you two are joined now for all time. Even death cannot separate you."
"Thanks be to God," Melisande said, and made the sign of the cross.
Next day, the 8th day of October, a Tuesday, the feast day of St. Benedicta, under a clear sky, the army marched. They went north, following the coastline, and Hook felt the army's spirits rise as they rode away from the smell of shit and death. Men grinned for no apparent reason, friends teased each other cheerfully, and some put spurs to horses and just galloped for the sheer joy of being in open country again. Sir John Cornwell commanded the army's vanguard, and his own men were in the van of the van and so rode at the very front of the column. Sir John's banner flew between the cross of St. George and the flag of the Holy Trinity, the three standards guarded by Sir John's men-at-arms and followed by four mounted drummers who beat incessantly. The archers rode ahead, scouting the path, and watching for an enemy whose first appearance was an ambush, though none of Sir John's men was involved. The French had waited until the well-armed and vigilant vanguard had come by, then had sallied from Montivilliers, a walled town close to the road. Crossbowmen shot from the woods and a group of men-at-arms charged the column, and there was a flurry of fighting before the attackers, who numbered fewer than 50 men, were beaten off, though not before they had managed to take a half-dozen prisoners and leave two English dead. That skirmish occurred on the first day, but thereafter the French seemed to fall back into sleep, and so the English men-at-arms rode unarmoured, their mail and plate carried by the sumpter horses. The riders' different coloured jerkins gave the mounted column a holiday appearance, enhanced by the banners flying at the head of every contingent. The women, pages and servants rode behind the men-at-arms, leading pack horses loaded with armour, food and the great bundles of arrows. Sir John's company had two light carts, one loaded with food and plate armour, the other heaped with arrows. When Hook turned in his saddle, he saw a filmy cloud of dust pluming over the low hills and heavy woods. The dust marked the trail of England's army as it twisted through the small valleys leading towards the River Somme. And to Hook it appeared to be a large army, but in truth it was a defiant band of fewer than 10,000 men, and only looked larger because there were over 20,000 horses. On the Sunday they dropped out of the small, tight hills into a more open and flatter countryside. Sir John had suggested that this was the day they should reach the Somme, and had added that the Somme was the only major obstacle on their journey.
Cross that river and they would have a mere 3 days marching to Calais.
So there won't be a battle? Michael Hook asked his brother.
Lord Slayton's men were also in the vanguard, though Sir Martin and Thomas Peril stayed well clear of Sir John and his men.
They say no, Hook said, but who knows?
The French won't stop us.
They don't seem to be trying, do they? Hook said, nodding at the empty country ahead. He and the rest of Sir John's archers were a half mile in front of the column, leading the way to the river.
Maybe the French are happy to see us go, he suggested. They're just leaving us be, perhaps.
You've been to Calais, Michael said, impressed that his elder brother had travelled so far and seen so much since last they were together.
Strange little town it is, Hook said. A vast wall and a great castle, and a huddle of houses. But it's the way home, Michael, the way home.
I just got here, Michael said ruefully.
Maybe we'll come back next year, Hook said, and finish the job.
End of Disc 7.